Welcome to The Mentor Files. I'm your host, Monica Royer, founder of Monica and Andy. If I've learned anything about running a business, it's that I've got so much left to learn. Join me as I chat with some of the world's most inspiring CEOs, passionate entrepreneurs, and experts at the top of their field to bring you invaluable insider advice and candid conversation about their journey to success. Here we go. Welcome to our very first episode of The Mentor Files. Part of the reason that I wanted to start this podcast is I feel like I have access to a great group of advisors, and I wanted to share some of the advice that they were giving me with the wider audience. I really am on a mission to help other entrepreneurs, as I know how difficult starting your own company can be. My very first guest is Andy Dunn, the CEO and founder of Bonobos, and he's most definitely my favorite. Andy is not only my younger brother, but he is the Andy in Monica and Andy. He founded Bonobos in 2007 with the goal of providing men with better fitting pants. The line started with khakis and now includes casual and dress shirts, suits, swim, and outerwear. Bonobos and the team there has revolutionized retail for men with the digital first experience. And in many ways, they've revolutionized retail with digital first for so many companies that have followed, including mine. There are a lot of great points that Andy makes. I think the number one takeaway is the five qualities that you need to look for in employees and that you need to look for as you're hiring your team. After listening to him, it really has revolutionized the way that I interview and the way that I hire. One of the other things that we talked about is there any such thing as an expert? Should you hire experts, which can certainly be expensive, or hire passionate people over time that can be trained? And finally, Andy gives us the tip on the number one book he feels every entrepreneur needs to read. I hope you enjoy the podcast as much as I did. Welcome, Andy Dunn from New York, CEO and founder of Bonobos, to today's podcast. I'm sure my listeners are excited to get to know you a little bit better.
Or maybe not.
In full disclosure, Andy is not only the CEO and founder of Bonobos, but he is also my younger brother and one of my most favorite humans on earth. So if this podcast turns out to be biased to those listening, it's because I am completely biased towards Andy. No question about that. And actually, Andy, that's a good place to start. Obviously, there's a lot of brothers and sisters out there, not anyone probably dumb enough to work together as we've done over the years in different capacities. But one of the things I was thinking about as I put together some notes for this interview, and I didn't put together very many notes because I feel like I know your background fairly well. What do you think about our relationship makes us a little bit different and able to work together?
I guess that assumes we're doing a good job of working together. mostly you're doing all the working and I'm on occasion fielding your phone calls. And obviously I come to your board meetings. I think we have to credit mom and dad, right? They, regardless of the fact that we work together on Monica and Andy now, and independent of the fact that mom named the brand, I think that they made sure to keep their kids close. And I think that that probably starts with not favoring one child over the other.
Agreed. I think that's right.
Although they favored you a little bit.
I feel like they favored you. I feel like they favored you.
Maybe that's the trick.
I see we see it differently. That's pretty funny.
No, yeah. Let's be honest. They favored me.
Yes, I agree. Well, you know what? I think one of the other things that I thought of, I agree. I think that mom and dad have been great examples for us. And I think that something other people could potentially take away from this is that, and you and I both know that this has been the most difficult part of things, but I feel like ultimately we're able to be relatively honest with each other. And so I think that's helped. I mean, it certainly makes things more difficult in those moments of honesty. But, you know, my thoughts even after the last board meeting is I appreciate that when you're working with somebody that they don't tell you what you want to hear, but what you need to hear. And I feel like you've always done a good job of that for me. And hopefully I've done a good job of that for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, the reality of what we do together now with you leading and building Monica and Andy and me being your occasional advisor, it's really just an inversion of a relationship that we had for the last 10 years at Bonobos where you've been my advisor. And I think so much of building something is not necessarily about the tactics or the strategies of business. It's about managing your own psychology. And obviously you've been not just helping with that, but for a long time, really enabling it, enabling me to survive the ups and downs of building something. And so now it's fun that now you are in the hot seat.
I am in the hot seat. And I feel so much more empathy for you now that I've been in the hot seat than I did when I was just giving you random advice, which is so easy to do in retrospect. You know, I never understood the back-to-back emailing and how busy you were and your, you know, lack of time to be able to do what seemed like basic things at times. And now I, you know, I feel that times a million doing this and, you know, obviously with Bella. So it's, I feel for you, and I can't, sometimes I can't believe that you did this for 10 years. It seems almost like an impossibility. But that said, what you're touching on in terms of a support system for entrepreneurs in general, how important do you feel like having that support system set up before you actually embark on something? How important is that?
Look, I think in the case of Bonobos, I think that Bonobos would not be a company at this stage if it weren't for having had three people in the early innings engaged, almost ensuring it would succeed because of their guidance. One is you, as we've discussed on a personal front. And then the other two are our first two angel investors, Joel and Andy. Joel Peterson, who's the chairman of JetBlue, Andy Ratcliffe, who's the CEO of Wealthfront. And as you now know, if you don't have people to call on day in and day out when you're having a challenge, who can either help you with a personal challenge or a professional challenge, you're really alone. And it's already a lonely job. You know, I've got a mentor who jokes, if you're a CEO and you want a friend, get a dog. And I think in your case, your strategy was, if I want to be a CEO, have a kid. Because Bella's your buddy.
Yeah.
And so I really think it's unfortunate that from the outside, it looks like the entrepreneur is responsible for their success, when in reality, it's the people around them who are equally, if not more, responsible.
That's absolutely right. And given that, you know, if we look at the outside of, you know, the Bonobo story to those, you know, just watching and reading the headlines, it looks like a textbook, you know, sort of story tale almost from, you know, the start at Stanford Business School. And, you know, it's funny as I think of my recollections of that and, you know, mom and dad coming out there for your graduation dinner and hearing that you were going to start an online men's pants company in 07 and how really sort of initially devastated they were that you weren't taking a regular job. I mean, it's yeah, hilarious in retrospect. But that said, how, and obviously I know this, but for people listening, how truly difficult is the behind the scenes of, you know, what looks like a storybook on the outside?
Well, it's funny. I was talking to mom last night, and obviously she has a daughter who's an entrepreneur and a founding CEO, a son who is, a son-in-law who is, and for a period of time, a future daughter-in-law who was an entrepreneur. And I think we were joking, and I said, being an entrepreneur is it's half living the dream and it's half living a nightmare. You know, on certain days, like today, this call, like just talking to you, discussion and realizing what we're both doing and what we've both done, it's pretty special to be doing this. And then on other days where you're, you know, 2 weeks away from missing payroll, or you realize that something you've been working on for 18 months is a strategy that doesn't make sense, or you realize that you've made a mistake and not been focused enough and it could compromise what you're doing, or when you have to fire someone who is really a good person and really wanted something to work, but it's not working, it's tough. And so I think in some regards, your job becomes like, how do you ride the roller coaster? And how good do you get at, when you're at the top of the roller coaster, staying humble and staying healthily paranoid, right, about what could go wrong? And then when you're at the bottom of the roller coaster, how do you pull yourself out? And how do you summon the courage and the motivation, and if required, the goodwill and positive energy and charisma that you'll still need to attract capital and to recruit people. And I think that's why Ben Horowitz's book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, is so inspiring to me. And the first time I saw his writing about how managing your own psychology is the hardest part about being a CEO, I found that so courageous of him that he wrote that, because I think it's the thing we talk about the least. You know, there's something in capitalism and, you know, innovation and entrepreneurship where we put the ideas about the business ahead of the feelings that you have as a leader trying to navigate really difficult emotional terrain. And so I feel fortunate that I was able to navigate that difficult emotional terrain with your help, you know, with mom and dad's help, with the help of great angel investors. And then later, you know, when it comes to building a board and bringing on more institutional capital, you know, venture capitalists like Samir from Excel and Jeremy from Lightspeed and the Nordstrom family and the Chanel family office, at every turn, I feel like my job has been to bring more and more people who can support me. It's a bit selfish. It's like constructing, it's like constructing scaffolding.
Right.
And that scaffolding enables you to build the building. And I think from the outside, you look like you're the person responsible, but the reality is that you're responsible for creating the support that enables you to be the conduit by which the company gets built. And of course, you've got to make the tough calls when it comes to strategy and people. And of course, you've got to have the vision for what the company's going to do. But it really is more, you know, Charles de Gaulle said, when I want to know what France thinks, I ask myself, which I think is exactly wrong, versus my favorite quote on leadership, which is Lao Tzu, which is, when her aim complete and her work is fulfilled, the people will say, we did it ourselves, which is you almost want to become someone who people look at and say, you know what, that person doesn't really do that much. And it's really humbling now at Bonobos. You know, I just got out of our town call meeting where we have everyone there. And, you know, my instinct is that most people look at me and think, what does that guy actually do? And paradoxically, that's a sign of success, right? Which is you want to be in a company where people are so good that they look at the CEO and are like, what does that person do? And probably that means I also need to get better at what I do. But it's been humbling that the better Bonobos has become, the less I feel like it's because of me.
Well, and for those people listening that can't envision your town hall meeting, I feel fortunate to have attended one. And I don't know how large that room is, but it's 10 times the size of my office at least. And I mean the entire office here, not just my own office. And it's packed with people. I was wearing high heels and had to stand on my tiptoes just to see you. So, I mean, that's quite a team that you've amassed and that you get together for that town hall meeting. So, you know, it's interesting how far removed some of the people that are in that meeting may be from actually having spent a considerable amount of time with you, you know, since the early days. So in my mind, that's pretty impressive. But it also begs the question that, you know, at Bonobos, I've seen this myself. You've been able to carry your culture, your, you know, feelings of empathy and gratitude and your personality, you know, down to almost every guide shop. So anytime I've ever entered a Bonobos store, you know, not as your sister, but as just someone walking through the door, I'm always greeted with that same energy. And as somebody at my stage of the game, I wonder, how in the world do you do that? Because that's not very easy.
You know, it's not very easy, nor was it always this way. I think when we were at about 20 people, I had a crisis of confidence around my ability to recruit, because it seems like a few of the key players I had recruited weren't working out. And there wasn't as good of energy in the air as there was when we were five people. And so I kind of raised the flag that I needed help. And I got connected to Mark Lurie. And Mark is now the founder and CEO of Jet.com, Walmart acquired recently. And he heads up their whole e-commerce business now. Before that, he was the founding CEO of diapers.com and what became soapandwag.com as well. And I sat down with Mark and I asked him, I said, how do you hire people? And he said, you know, it's funny. I'm going to tell you something that someone told me 3 years ago and I didn't believe it at the time, but it turns out it's absolutely true, which is you take the thing that most people focus on the most, which is the experience that person has, and you sublimate that to two other things that are far more important. their passion for the mission of the company, the enterprise, number one. And number two, their fit with the team. And so I said, that's fine, Mark, but what does it even mean, passion for the mission? And he said, look, you're going to meet two kinds of people in hiring. You're going to meet the kind of people that are negotiating for title and salary. And then you're going to meet the kind of people that are more invested in equity and are excited to join the company irrespective of what their opening role is. And you'll be able to tell. And another investor of ours gave a sort of a funny rule of thumb, which is you offer one person more cash and less equity, and you offer the same person less cash and more equity. And if they take the offer with more cash and less equity, simply tell them that you don't want them. Now, that's a little bit intense.
Yeah.
But there's some truth to it, which is you want someone invested in the purpose of the company, and they're so passionate about that that it trumps some of the selfishness that typically comes into a recruiting process. So that's passion. And then when it comes to fit, he said, look, you've got to actually articulate what the fit is. And I said, Mark, isn't fit that like corny picture of like an eagle soaring in an office that says elevation? I mean, what really are those core values? And he said, they're not the core values you aspire to have. They're the ones you actually have. And so I rushed back to Bonobos, to the office at, then we were at 19th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan. And I made a list of the 30 people I had hired, the 10 people who were doing the best, 10 people who were in the middle, and then 10 people who hadn't worked out. You know, we had a 33% turnover rate at that stage. And when I looked at the top 10, you know, Tiffany Popa, Sarah Gray, John Rote, Chris Travers, Kevin Kelleher, Sarah Gregg, Kate Falk, that list that I made had five different things that I thought those people had in common: self-awareness, empathy, positive energy, judgment, and intellectual honesty. Self-awareness, can you know your strengths and weaknesses and own them both? Empathy, can you imagine the world deeply from the perspective of other people? Positive energy, you know, are you the opposite of a fun sponge? Do you put energy in a room rather than take it out, whether introverted or extroverted? Judgment, which is, do you make good decisions in the face of uncertainty, which is sort of the nature and the challenge of the human condition? And then intellectual honesty, which sounds a bit nerdy, but it's really, can you change your mind in the face of new information? Can you evolve your point of view? Or are you stuck believing what your historical self believed? And once we put those in place and we built them into how we hire, and most importantly, how we fire people, and having the courage to fire people who don't meet those core human values, or as Joel calls them, virtues. That then, over the course of the next 18 months, took the company from a place where we had lots of different kinds of humans to the same kind of human, but that had different kinds of experience and held different jobs. But fundamentally at Bonobos, we're all the same in terms of being invested in those types of personality traits and having cultivated them throughout our lives. And by the way, that's a function probably of whose people's parents are, who they were raised by,
right,
what kinds of education they got. And, you know, 6 quarters after that conversation with Mark, a year and a half, Bonobos was named the 16th best place to work in all of New York City by Cranes. And to this day, that is my proudest moment. And now here we are at 380 people, and we're not even on the Cranes top 50 list. Well, why is that if we understand this? It's because it's really hard, and because we're growing quickly, and we now require much more systems and infrastructure and much more erudite approaches to human resources and people operations to figure this out. And so this is like yoga. It's a daily practice, and it's really hard, but it's really fun.
And you say it's really fun, which I think is exciting, because I also find the job really fun in the face of all the things that are not fun about it. And looking at things from my perspective, I'm 2.5 years in, you're 10 and a half years in, something along those lines. What has been the evolution of the job for you? Like, is there light at the end of the tunnel for me in terms of the feeling of sort of running in quicksand on a day-to-day basis, even though I wouldn't complain about it? Or does it just feel like this forever?
So it's a little bit like the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland, which is you have to run faster and faster and faster to stay in the same place. And I think the challenge for people being an entrepreneur is you probably come from an environment where you are used to being a successful person. And as an entrepreneur, as a founding CEO, co-founder of something, as a member of a leadership team, or even any member of the team, it frequently can be the case that you feel like every day you're failing. And so someone told me something one day that helped me, which is on any given day, you can never accomplish the list that's in front of you. So you'll feel like a failure on any given day. When you look at what you accomplish over the course of a month, you still tend to feel like you underperform what you wanted to do. But if you fast forward to 3 months and 6 months, you can tend to outperform. And then within a year, you know, we just did our look back at 2016 at Bonobos, and it's kind of amazing what the team accomplished in a year. And then when you look at 10 years, when you really take the telescope back, it's absolutely stunning what you can do. I mean, 10 years ago, Bonobos didn't exist. And you go back to February of 2007, we hadn't sold a pair of pants. So, and so in a decade, we put a brand into the world that, you know, fortunately, it employs 380 people, and we serve something like 300,000 customers just in the last 12 months. And a lot of those people really love the brand. And so, unfortunately, the bad news that I have for you is every single day, you are going to feel like you're failing, with the exception of a few milestone moments. You know, you raise capital, a great press story. You, as I did, get to tell the team today that you beat all your numbers. So there are some moments of punctuated good feeling, and you have to be grateful for those moments, and you got to kind of pack them away and store them for a rainy day. And then the vast majority of the other days, you will feel like you're failing until you fully built a leadership team and until the business is profitable. And so I think what makes Bonobos amazing for me now is that we've fully built out the senior leadership team with experienced people who are passionate about the mission and who are strong cultural fits. And that was a 7-year journey, because we certainly couldn't recruit any experienced executives in the first 3 years, nor could we afford them.
Right.
And last year we just put the finishing touches on the team. You know, I'd highlight Dom, our head of technology, Mickey, our head of marketing, Antonio, our CFO and COO, Sarah, our head of people. And having built the full team out, finally, you can do what I've heard CEOs do, and you can take a step back and think. And what I heard is that part of the work of leadership is just thinking and time alone. And last I checked, for the last decade, I haven't done any thinking or spent any time alone. So it's
I know
really,
the feeling.
It's really nice now to recognize that actually it does change, but not until the company is making money and not until you've built an experienced executive team that is on belay working well together.
That's great. That's great to hear. And at least in the last 10 years, you've been able to shower by yourself. I usually have a 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old sitting outside the shower, so I don't even have that time to think.
Yeah, I don't know how you do it. I mean, I don't know what you think about this, but I heard that I once met a woman who's building a brand, a digitally native vertical lingerie and women's underwear brand called Peach. I don't know if she's still doing it, but she said she's done 3 companies in her life. 1 company where she had grown kids, 1 company where she had little kids, and 1 company where she had no kids. And she said, which one do you think was the easiest? And I said, when you had no kids. And she said, no, the easiest was when I had little kids, because little kids need you so much that you have no choice but to take care of them.
Yes.
And taking care of them provides you with the balance and the perspective that makes you more efficient at work. And it makes you realize that your work isn't the most important thing you do. She said the next best was having grown kids, because at least they need her a little bit. And she said the worst was when she had no kids, because there are no boundaries. And I think in a way, I'm not trying to set it up to say that your job now is easier than my job was for the last 10 years, but I really didn't know when to stop. And I think regardless of whether you have kids or not, it is hard to know the boundary of when do you actually take a breather? Can you take a breather? And you know, on your side, given how busy you are taking care of Bella, living in the same building as our mom and dad, you know, taking care of them, providing for your husband, you know, who's as busy as any of us. You're the hub of of two wheels, the family wheel and the Monica and Andy wheel. And so my hat is off to you, because I can't imagine that challenge.
I think it's true what your friend said in one big sense, which is that I think that I don't have time to waste. And so wasting time can be very, very fun, but there is a relief that Bella provides for me, even though on a minute to minute basis, that relief usually comes when I give her a hug after she's asleep. but just her presence does force me, like you said, with little kids, you are forced to just disengage because they demand your full attention. And I think that's probably healthy, where it doesn't necessarily hurt me more, but I don't have as much time to network and get to know people and be out and about, which could ultimately just be a waste of time. I'm not sure. It forces me to just pick what are the most important things in the day to do, and then to just do them. And so at Monica and Andy, we've had a lot of fun working with a lot of moms, just because I, tend to attract people that are very, very much like me to the company. And it's a very efficient team, I think, because of that, because, we have a certain amount of time to get stuff done and we just get it done. So I think that everyone's always envious of the other side of things. Obviously, I couldn't imagine a world without Bella. So, and I wouldn't have done, this company was inspired by her, so I wouldn't have done it if it weren't for her. But there certainly is a day-to-day challenge of, as you said, being at the hub of two wheels. And then I not only feel like I'm failing at one wheel, but the other. And then how much vulnerability do you want to show your team? Your team looks to you to be a source of strength and to be a source of, courage and passion and initiative for what you're doing. And it's great to have people like you or Rob or, mom, who I can call on the way to work and sometimes just, freak out at before I get here. Because sometimes the stress does become a lot. So I wouldn't change what I'm doing, but I think it's definitely something to acknowledge that, it's different to build companies at different stages of life. And so this is definitely a stage of life. And I realize at some point, this is maybe the luckiest stage of life, because so many different people need me and want to spend time with me. And although that can be overwhelming, I realize without any number of those people, my life wouldn't be as full as it is. And so I feel at the end of it, very grateful, but I have to remind myself of that many times.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a lot that you said in there. And I think the main thing that you said is just the fact that being needed by other people is itself a gift to the person who is needed.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why parents don't wake up typically wondering what they're going to do in the morning is because they know that they have someone that needs them to do a lot of things, from providing for them to nurturing them, educating them, and just the logistics of life and managing those logistics, to say nothing of, the day-to-day love that you need to provide and pour in. And I think the beautiful thing about building a company is you're so needed, at least for the first decade. And then second decade, you got to figure out what you're doing. and there's something wonderful about that, but it's a responsibility that you have to accept that your life is not your own. You are basically sublimating your life to serving your company, to serving the team, to serving the people that have invested, to serving the people who you count as your customers, your lifeblood. And so there's a confusion that CEOs are served by their teams when it's actually the other way around.
Yes.
You're at the bottom of the org chart. You serve the people that work for you. And part of serving them may entail something like the realization that they're not right for the company. That's actually service to the company, is to move someone out who isn't being successful. It's a service to that person for their career. And it's a service to the company to make sure that you've got the right people in place. And so it's absolutely true on being needed, and the psychological fulfillment that you get from being needed is high. And, as you know, in 2015, I became the executive chairman of Bonobos for 86 days. And I'd like to think that I came back because we hadn't found the right mutual fit for a new CEO in the company, this new CEO that we hired, and the leadership team and the team were not meshing, which can frequently be the case from what I'd heard. But I'll be honest with you, I also felt a profound sense of emptiness not being needed every day. I can remember the first time we did a meeting where I was there and our new CEO was there and everyone was looking to her, and it was a very bewildering feeling. And from that, I had two takeaways from the whole experience. One is, don't say that fit matters and then not figure out how to do it for a CEO hire. And I consider that to be my failing, not the CEO we brought on, number one. And number two, next time, whenever the time comes that I'm going to do something different than be the CEO of Bonobos, make sure it's something where I'm going to be at least as needed. Because apparently the needy person is me.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And for somebody that was with you on the inside, I know that you and I aren't necessarily believers and everything happens for a reason. And that's a topic of a different conversation. But I do think, having watched the many transitions that you've gone through, I think that I've seen you learn from each one, and perhaps the learning of the fact that, you know, you really did want to be where you were was a great one in the long term. And sometimes lessons are learned in really difficult ways, but I feel like you needed to go through the things that all of those transition to become the CEO who you are today, because you've certainly evolved in where you are, from my perspective, immensely, over 10 years as anybody would. And so I think that's an important takeaway too, for anybody listening to this, is sometimes the things that go wrong, the people that leave your company, those are, those things that sometimes you feel like that is your personal failure, are actually the biggest learnings. And without those, you couldn't evolve.
Yeah, there's a great story that Manuela tells me, my fiance, which is the story of the lost horse. And it's a Chinese parable about a guy who loses his best horse. And he goes to his father and he says, "I lost my best horse. I'm ruined." His father says to him, "How do you know it's not a blessing?" And he goes away grumbling, being like, "What is dad talking about?" And then sure enough, the Mongols invade and every man with a good horse is sent to battle and they're all killed. And he goes back to his father and he goes, "Dad, you were right. My life was spared." And his father goes, "How do you know it's not a curse?" And he goes back to the town, and sure enough, because he's the only living man, they make him the mayor of the town. And as a result of that, his son, the wise old man's grandson, tries to have him killed so he can take over. And he goes to his father and he says, "You were right. My son is after my job. He's plotting against me." And his father goes, "How do you know it's not a blessing?" And he goes back to his son. And then sure enough, they have a huge falling out and they patch their relationship up. And then their relationship is better. And he runs back to the grandfather, the wise man, and says, "You were right." And his father goes, "How do you know it's not a curse?" And he goes back to town. And sure enough, the grandson, the mayor's son, because of their new proximity, has a wife who falls in love with her father-in-law. And it just keeps looping. And there are endless variants of the story in Chinese society that have been passed down over the millennia. The moral of the story is this, which is everything good comes later with some bad, and everything bad comes later with some good. And it's very hard to see life that way because you're seduced by good things. You know, seeing yourself on TV, like no matter what you think, it's going to have a negative impact on your personality. it just is.
Yes.
Whereas being unable to raise funding and fearing that you're going to be viewed as a failure is like a meat grinder on your self-esteem. And you're so worried about the company and the people that work for you. And yet that probably is a much better development than getting on the front page of the business section of, the New York Times. And I think there's something to life, to starting to look at bad news as something that you welcome in. You kind of say like, "Okay, welcome, here you are. Like, come sit down, like be with me now," because that is going to actually be the fuel for growth, and it's going to provide more sustenance and meaning. And then taking the good news and looking at it and being like, "I know you actually are bringing with you something bad. Like, I'm not going to be seduced by you.
Right.
Whether it's money, whether it's fame, whether it's people pumping you up and saying you're so great, that actually is all potentially really bad. And so it's this strange thing where you got to start to acknowledge that what you're really looking for is meaning. You know, the three schools of Viennese psychology, the first one was Adler, who says that man is in search of power. Then Freud, who said that man is in search of pleasure. The most recent, I think, being the most close to the truth, at least for me, which is Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor who saw his parents and his wife both perish. Possible thing to imagine. He said that man is in search of meaning. And hopefully he also meant woman. But I think there's something to that, which is that what we're all really looking for is meaning. That's why we start families. That's why we start companies. That's why we try to find a state of flow in what we do and the work that we do, whatever it may be. And meaning comes from strife and stress. And so you have to welcome it. But as you know, you're welcoming a lot if you try to start something that doesn't exist.
Absolutely. And while we're talking about that and kind of the downside of things, let's talk about the role that criticism and radical candor, as you've spoken about, play a role in the evolution of a company, a CEO. And as we're talking about it, let's discuss mom for a second, who was the first person to teach us radical candor as kids. What are your thoughts on the harshest criticism that you've received and how that's made you a better CEO?
Oh, I can tell you right now, I had raised a few angel investment rounds. And we got to a place where I wasn't able to raise the next round. At least it didn't look like I was going to be able to. And so I went back to one of my early investors and I said, like, effectively, hey, would you be willing to put in some more money? And he just said, I'm so disappointed in you. And I think I'm so disappointed in you are the 4 to 5 most powerful words in affecting someone's life.
Yes.
Because it's the disappointment of someone who loves you and who you admire and who you love. It's so much harder to bear that than even their anger. Anger begets anger back. Disappointment just makes you feel like shit.
Yes.
And so I really felt that I had let him down. And at the same time, you know, not long earlier, I had an opportunity to raise money at one price and things were going really well for the company. And I jacked up the price on that round. And a different angel investor was upset that I had changed the price upward. And so here I had been greedy and nearly lost angel investor number two. And then because I did that, later I disappointed angel investor number one. And I had been told by everyone, you know, don't be greedy when it comes to raising money. And I think the rule here is that the thing that you think the world wants from you, like driving the highest price for what the company's worth, is actually not what the world wants from you. What the world wants from you is to do very difficult work of actually creating something that can exist and thrive and prosper. And can actually continue to create jobs and continue to delight customers. And maybe it's not going to make as much money for your shareholders as you would if you were entirely optimizing for price. You know, that won't matter if you're taking a thoughtful and a step-by-step approach to how you stage what you're doing. And it took me a long time as a insecure guy with a lot of arrogance to figure out that my job was to be a shepherd of something that was going to stay alive, not to, you know, chase a headline about what the valuation of the company was. And I remember it was a very humbling time from 2007 to 2012, the first 5 years of the company, because we had Gilt Group and we had Fab and we had One Kings Lane and we had all these really hot e-commerce companies that were just raising money like crazy in these big valuations. And in a lot of ways, I felt like Bonobos was sort of plodding along, this, you know, internet's driven pants brand, selling pants on the internet, not really hugely on the radar screen. And I felt like a failure. And now I'm so humble to say, you know, we're here and we've reinvented how a retail brand is built. And we've got a company that is, you know, making money in 2017. And a lot of those high flying names they're gone. You know, they're gone or they've been sold for less than the amount of capital that went in. And so I wish I could go back and tell that person, you know, this really never is going to be about the money. It never is. And it's not even about the money for the people that invested in your company. It's about winning. And it's about ultimately building something that matters. That's actually what those people care about. And the money that comes out of it is a byproduct of that.
Right.
But it's hard to figure that out from day one. And it's hard to have enough arrogance to actually have the audaciousness to build something, but enough humility to be successful at building it. And so, you know, what makes you remarkable is I don't perceive you as arrogant at all. And yet you're still able to have the conviction that you alone are in a position to create something that is the really, you know, the next generation meaningful, not just baby clothing brand, but baby clothing experience and, you know, force for innovation in the baby category. And I think that makes you, in a lot of ways, a more enlightened and self-actualized entrepreneur than I was when I started Bonobos at the ripe young age of 28.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
I'm not calling you old, by the way.
It's nice of you to say. The one thing I will say that I agree with is I do think there is a really true humbleness that sets in once you've been doing it for a while. In the sense that I actually feel like when I started this, I was a lot more confident and I thought I knew a lot more than I do today. Today, I realize how little I actually know in a good way, you know, how much there is still to learn and how many people I still need to learn from. Because, and that's one of the interesting things with this, even with this podcast, is getting a chance and a peek to talk to so many different experts and realize, wow, there's still such a long way to go. At this stage of the game, do you feel like you can say that you're an expert in some things? Do you feel comfortable labeling yourself an expert?
So this is really kind of fun, but when I was growing up, I used to think about like, wow, that person is an expert. And then what I've come to realize is I actually don't think there are any experts in anything. Like the more I've done this, the more I realize that no one really knows what they're doing. There are people that know on a relative basis more than others, but even those people don't quite know. And so as you ascend and you get to meet people that know more and more and more, for sure you'll get to a level of competence. But the most expert-like people, when you finally meet them, actually don't think they're expert at what they do.
Yes. And by the way, that was the best advice you ever gave me at the start of this for people listening, was that nobody really knows what they're doing. Just pretend like you know what you're doing and eventually you'll get there.
I mean, I don't want to get political, but you know, would anyone have said that, you know, Donald Trump is an expert at politics and now, you know, the president of the formerly free world? So I think it's proof that what you said is perfectly accurate, which is don't think you don't know enough to do what you want to do because no one knows what they're doing.
And do you think that lends to what you said earlier about hiring? And I'm grappling, these are the things that I'm grappling with now, is do you hire somebody that's done it or somebody that's never done it but has the passion to do it? Those are, you know, how would you make those choices for your team? If I, you know, I'm calling and saying, hey, I've got this person, they know what they're doing. I've got someone that doesn't know what they're doing, but they're really excited to do it. Who would you choose for me?
You know, I think it's a wonderful question. And I think it's in a lot of ways, it's a question that has a nuanced answer. I think, you know, I have a huge man crush on Theo Epstein. And if you look at what Theo did to guide the Cubs to their first title in 108 years, he actually recruited both. So his infield was a bunch of people that have never done it, but who are about to do it. Chris Bryant, Addison Russell, Javier Baez, Anthony Rizzo, all these are guys in their early 20s who've never been on the highest stage. And wow, did they perform. And then you had guys like John Lester and Ben Zobrist, you know, the back-to-back World Series MVP, and David Ross. These were guys that had done it before. And then you look at the coach, Joe Maddon, he had done it before with the Rays. So I think you actually want to blend. You want to look at that common core set of human values that you're looking for. You want to hire 100% of people within those values. And then you want to pair experienced people who have done it before with people that are about to do it. And generally those about to do it folks are in roles that are more junior, but you can have a couple of people that haven't done it before in senior roles. Your ability to do that as a blend increases over time, because when the company is really small, you can't get the people that have done it before.
Right.
Because they're going to look at you a little cross-eyed. But the ones that have got a little bit of a twinkle in their eye, you will get them later. So, you know, I can remember the first time I met Dwight Fenton. We sat down for breakfast 3 years before I hired him. And I said, what do you think of what we're doing? And he said, I don't get it. And, you know, we had a great breakfast. And I said, would you ever consider coming to do this? And he was like, no. And I walked out and I thought, well, that was kind of a sad meeting. And then, you know, 3 years later, he became the VP of design at Bonobos. And now he's our chief creative officer and he's been here for 4 years. And I could probably tell you, you know, 12 or 15 stories like that of people who I couldn't get at the time, but who you get later. And then you need to blend that in with the people who are willing to do it. And then the really devastating part of this is that later you will have people who came for passion, who couldn't make it because they were learning on the job, who you then have to say, thank you for getting me here, but I now can get someone more experienced than you. And that, unfortunately, is a part of building a company that's working, and it's a heartbreaking thing to experience. Every time it's heartbreaking. If you do your job well, what you get to do is help that person figure out what they're going to do next and make darn sure that their next step is one where they can look back at their time at Monik and Andy and say, that was an amazing springboard for my career.
That's great, because those are some of the hardest decisions to make. And like you said, for 2.5 years ago, it wasn't even a decision. Everyone that was working with me was completely inexperienced and incredibly passionate. And, you know, that's certainly gotten us to where we are now. But, you know, the idea of the blend is exciting, because I can certainly see opportunities where bringing in somebody that knows what they're doing, it instead of us reinventing a wheel that's already been invented, could be very beneficial. And I think there's probably a lot of other people that are at a similar stage to me in all different types of companies that are wondering, because hiring and firing are definitely two of the most stressful things, in addition to raising capital and the things that really do keep you up at night. And it wouldn't be a full interview with you without asking one last question about capital raise, because you've been so incredibly instrumental to me in terms of, you know, being a champion in terms of, you know, telling me how to raise capital and who are the types of people to raise capital for. And I feel so fortunate to have had your mentorship and leadership there. And one of the things that I've seen as I continued to build this brand is there are so many great female entrepreneurs out there. I mean, great male entrepreneurs as well, but I find a lot of the female entrepreneurs don't know as much about their ability to access capital, or the fact that they can potentially go out and raise money. And so what would be your advice to somebody that has not raised money before, but is getting to that stage? What would be your one or two best practices for fundraising? And you've taught me so many of them, but for somebody listening, what would be one or two things that would be your advice in terms of going out and raising capital?
Well, as it goes to the gender issue, I just want to say, I think it's a tremendously unfair setup. You know, I think we've made a lot of progress in America with getting to a place where the majority of undergraduates now, as I understand this, are women, not men. But when it comes to equality in the workforce in terms of compensation, representation in the C-suite of companies, percentage and proportion of entrepreneurs, board participation, you know, the highest echelons of government, we're so far away from where we need to be. And, you know, my own belief, and maybe this is going to be considered too blunt by some people, is that raising money is an absolute boys' club. It's largely men who give money to men. And yet the data shows, from the small cohort of women who are actually getting funded, not just as founders or co-founders, but as founding CEOs, that cohort outperforms the guys, right? And I think you know my philosophy on this, which is that women are like men, except they're just a little bit better on almost every dimension. More empathy, more self-awareness, typically better with money. I think the thing that women lack, that men have in spades, that women need to develop, is hubris, which is men have this gene where they are super aggressive and super sometimes unrealistic in their belief about what they can do, and, you know, unabashed about saying what they want whenever they want. And that those characteristics lend themselves well to entrepreneurship. It's being, you know, brash in some regards. And I think women have got a impossible challenge, which is they're not supposed to show up that way. Or they're not expected to show up that way. And then they have to go out and raise money from a world that's largely dominated by men.
Yes.
I mean, Kirsten Green, who's on my board, who's been an investor with me for a decade and who is a gem of a human being, is literally one of the only women I can think of in Silicon Valley who runs her own investment firm, and where the, you know, where the team is largely female. Now, there are more people being inspired by her example. There's Aileen Lee at Cowboy Ventures, who just hired my good friend and our former outside counsel, Ted Wang. There are great female angel investors popping up, like Gotham Gale, which is Joanne Wilson here in New York. I almost just called her Fred Wilson's wife, which is just like a great example of the problem, because her husband's an amazing venture capitalist. And so it's Fred Wilson's wife. And so we need more Joanne Wilsons and fewer Fred Wilson's wives. We need more Kirsten Greens and Aileen Lees. And then we need more women to have the conviction and courage and belief in themselves that not only can they be every bit as good as the next guy, but even better. And, you know, that's why what you're doing is so important. That's why what Katya is doing is so important, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, my advice is just be aware that it's totally unfair. Be aware that raising money, even as a guy, is hard. And then recognize that the tenacity that you are going to need to demonstrate, and the relentless, fearless persistence day to day, you know, the kind of Chumbawamba, I get knocked down, but I get up again approach. You are going to need to do that every day, day in and day out, until you have whatever investment you need to get going. And to the extent that it's not working, that doesn't necessarily mean give up. It just may mean evolve what you're trying to do. And ultimately, you know, I'm converting to Judaism right now. It's a little bit like that, which is come to the rabbi the first time and get turned away, come to the rabbi a second time and get turned away, come the third time and get taken in. You have to keep going again and again and again and again to new people and the same people, showing them the progress that you've made. And you need to really figure out, it's really a small ecosystem in a lot of ways. You can probably count, you know, on one Google Doc, the 500 people that matter when it comes to raising capital for early stage companies, whether they're prolific angel investors or they work at certain firms. And you've got to shake that tree down. And it's something where it's extremely difficult, even for those that aren't at a disadvantage. And so I say all that not to be, hopefully not to discourage, but to provide a real clarity of what the table setting is, so that folks who decide they want to do this recognize exactly how dedicated they'll have to be.
Well, I'm grateful to the leadership that I've been lucky to have from you and the mentorship. And I hope that people listening to this will be able to get a peek into what I've been so privileged to experience with you. Because we need more people like you that are encouraging women like us to do what what we're able to go out there and do. So thank you, Andy, for, you know, for being such a resource and a mentor and, you know, a guide for me. I certainly wouldn't be able to do it without you. And it's part of the inspiration behind this podcast, because I want this advice from you and from other mentors like yourself to go far beyond my ears and into the ears of many other people that could benefit. So I really appreciate you coming on today, and hopefully people listening will be able to get that same feeling that I'm able to get from you when we have a quick chat on the phone about these things. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I would just say in closing that the reason why I think you're going to succeed is because you care enough about the people who are listening to this to want to transfer this onto them rather than just keep it for yourself. And so to all of you out there, please keep buying a lot of baby clothes so we can be successful.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. For more information and tips from our guests, stop by monicaandandy.com or check us out on Instagram at Monica and Andy. If there's someone you want to hear from or have any other suggestions, please leave us a comment on iTunes. Thank you for listening.